What better way to spend a very highly charged day than to be learning Torah together and doing what we're supposed to be doing? This is the Kihu Chayechem Ve'orachem Echem. This is what we're here in the world to do. Politics is a side factor of our lives, but this is the primary focus of what we do every day of our lives. So today we're going to talk about the mitzvah of Bris Milah. And you'll say, why is Bris Milah of interest to a group of women who normally are not the ones who are involved in performing the mitzvah of Bris Milah? Hopefully we'll show how the mitzvah of Bris Milah is something that has many, many ancillary issues that come about through that as well, that will be of great relevance to all of us. So let's begin with the following. Just to frame our discussion for today, why I chose to speak about the mitzvah of Bris Milah is because it is clear from the sources, from the Gemara, from the Midrashim, that Bris Milah is something that is so fundamental. It is such a dominating mitzvah. It is so central to our belief. It is symbolic in some way of everything that a Jew stands for. As we see in the Gemara, Nedarim Daf Lamed Beis, you look in the first entry, Rebbe Omer Gedola Mila, she shekula keneged kol ha-mitzvahs. Mila is something that is in some way equal, it is in some way parallel to all the mitzvahs HaTorah. So therefore it has a very primary significance in everything we try to do. Davar Acher, says the Gemara, Gedola Mila, Mila is so much highlighted, more so than other mitzvahs. Shel male Mila, lo niskaimu shamayim va'aretz. If not for the mitzvah of Bris Milah, we would not have a world. We would not have shamayim va'aretz. As it says in the Pasuk, im lo brisi yomam v'layla, chuko shamayim va'aretz lo samti. So this is a little bit of a picture of how important this mitzvah is. And we can talk all year about the mitzvah of Milah. There is so much to say. There is so much halacha that revolves around this mitzvah. But today we're going to talk about very few of the issues that I think are of extremely important relevance, and those issues that we may not be aware of. The Medrash Tanchuma writes in number Beis, Amar Ab Yitzchak, Nemar B'mila Avoda. It says by Bris Milah, the word Avoda. We refer to the Bris Milah as an Avoda. V'nemar B'karbanos Avoda. When we offer sacrifices, when we offer a carbon in the Beis HaMikdash, we refer to that as well as an Avoda. Says the Medrash, Ma Avoda Ha'amura B'karbanos Damim. Just like when you offer a sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash on the Mizbeach, we require that you have to have blood that is going to be shechted. You have to have an animal that will be shechted and now blood will come out. Af avoda ha'amura b'mila damim. So too by the Bris Milah, we have to do an act which will evoke a response of blood. And now the Medrash says, Kivan she'adam matif tipa achas of blood comes out by the act of Milah, and it's a great sacrifice on our part to do the Bris Milah. Someone just mentioned Avraham Avinu. He was asked to do the mitzvah of Bris Milah in this week's Parsha. He didn't know what he was doing. Nobody did it before him. There was no precedent for this. It was a great act of doing something that took tremendous courage on his part. And throughout the generations, we know that the mitzvah of Bris Milah was something that we did with such great sacrifice. It is something that we gave up so much for. As we'll see if we have time in the end, the story on the back of the page, if we don't read it together, you should read it on your own. It is a snippet from the three-volume sefer called She'al Avicha V'Yageidcha, which is a compilation of the drashos of Rav Shalom Shvadron in Hebrew. So this is a story that he related, and again, it just highlights how much we have given up over the generations for the mitzvah of Bris Milah and how seriously we have taken it. We consider it to be such a fundamental part of our religion. And here Avraham Avinu chooses to sacrifice so much and to give himself up to do the Bris Milah, not only on himself, but on his children as well. The Medrash writes that it was one of the Asar Nisyonos of Avraham Avinu. This was one of the great tests. Why was it such a great test? Not just because it was an incision that he had to do and he didn't exactly know the mechanism of how to do a successful surgery, but it's clear that the reason why this was such a tremendous challenge for him is because Avraham Avinu was the one who was so involved in inclusion. He wanted everybody to be a part of his belief. He wanted everybody to come along and be a part of everything he was doing. And now he's going ahead and separating himself. So now what are people going to say? Your whole life you've been working to mend the relationships and to show everybody the beauty of your lifestyle and to show how we're together. And now you're doing something that's going to separate us. Now you're doing something that's going to show that you have no interest in being like this. This was so antithetical to everything Avraham Avinu invested his whole life in. And that's why Avraham Avinu yet goes ahead and does it, because he shows his emunah, he shows how much he's willing to sacrifice, and that's what has given us the courage and the strength throughout all the generations to give up so much for this very beautiful mitzvah, for this very important mitzvah of Bris Milah. The Medrash says over here, once the tipa of dam is spilled, once the blood comes out, hi chaviva lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu kekarbanos. That is as beloved in front of the eyes of God as if we had offered a karban. And Lufikach says the Medrash, when Avram Avinu did the Bris Milah on himself, Nigla HaKadosh Baruch Hu El Avram Kishamal. God now has an appointment with Avram Avinu. God shows up to visit Avram Avinu. Kishem Shenigla B'Karbanos, the same way that the reaction, that the response of God when we offer a carbon is, Ki Hashem Nira Lechem, that God will come and speak to you, so to speak. God's presence will be there. So too Avram Avinu is worthy of having the presence of God once he goes ahead and makes sure to do the act of the Bris Milah. So this is something that is a very important and central mitzvah, and that's what we're going to discuss today. We begin with the following. The Rambam writes in Hilchos Milah Paragimel Halacha Gimel, and that is the third entry on the source sheet. Avi HaBen Mevarech Shehechiyanu. When we go ahead and perform the act of a Bris Milah, the father of the child is supposed to recite the bracha of Shehechiyanu. Now, we have all attended Brisim, and I would imagine that we have never heard the bracha of Shehechiyanu be recited. You look in the Rambam, in Hilchos Brachos, Perek Yud Aleph, Halacha Tes, where he reiterates the very same sentiment. V'chein mitzvah she'ena tadira. When you have a mitzvah that comes along infrequently, ve'ena mitzuyah b'chales. It's not the kind of mitzvah that we can do every day of the year. Says the Rambam, for example, kigon milas b'no u'pidyon haben, when you perform a bris milah, or when you have the opportunity to do a pidyon haben, which is very unusual, mivarech aleihem b'shas asiyasam shehechiyanu. You will recite a shehechiyanu at the time that you perform those mitzvahs. So, this is the opinion of the Rambam. However, the other Rishonim all disagree with him. The other Rishonim feel that it is not appropriate to recite a shehechiyanu when we are performing the mitzvah of Bris Milah. And the question is, why? If, in fact, the criterion for reciting Shehechiyanu is when you have a mitzvah that comes along, mizman lizman, something that's an infrequent kind of mitzvah, why shouldn't we recite Shehechiyanu when we do a Bris Milah the same way we would recite a Shehechiyanu when we do anything else? The first time we blow shofar during the year, the first time we shake a lulav during the year, the first time we light Hanukkah candles, why should we not do the same thing when we have the opportunity to do a Bris Milah? Hopefully it only comes around once a year. People are not having two children in 1 year. But it's something that we would assume should have warranted a Shehechiyanu. Why do the Rishonim say no? And the answer that the Rishonim give is because Shehechiyanu has to be said with a certain frame of mind. Shehechiyanu has to be recited when you're in a state of excitement, when you're really happy inside. And therefore, when you have the Bris Milah being performed, there is a Tzara D'Yanuka. The child is crying, the parents are anxious, the parents are nervous. Is everything going to be healthy? Is everything going to be okay? It's something that we're very concerned about. And because inside we have a feeling of anxiety, a feeling of nervousness, this is the reason why a Shehechiyanu is left out at the time when we do a Bris Milah. There's an unbelievable insight, an absolutely incredible psychological insight. I don't know if it's correct or not, but it's an insight to be aware of. We have over here a concept that most of the Rishonim assume. We do not recite a Shehechiyanu when we do a Bris Milah. In Eretz Yisrael, they follow the Rambam's opinion. They do recite a Shehechiyanu. But here in America, we don't. What's the reason why we don't, as we mentioned? Because there's this factor of Tzara D'Yanuka. We have pain because of the fact that the child is having a Bris Milah. The child is in pain. We're in pain. Therefore, a Shehechiyanu is not recited. We're not in the proper frame of mind. There is a Gemara in Brachos where the Gemara tells us that when you have a person who, God forbid, loses a parent, the halacha is you're supposed to recite a hatova hametiv. You say a dayan ha'emes, because that's a very sad time, it's a sad period of life, but at the same time you recite a hatova hametiv. Why do you recite a hatova hametiv? Why is this an exciting time? Hatova hametiv is the parallel bracha to Shehechiyanu. Why do you say a hatova hametiv? The Gemara says, because it's a very nice thing that you just got the Yerusha. So therefore a hatova hametiv should be recited over the Yerusha. So the Alter from Slabodka pointed out, this is a very strange phenomenon. Here we have a very exciting time, a Bris Milah, where we should have said a Shehechiyanu because we are very excited to perform the mitzvah, and yet we don't because we're crying inside that the child is in pain. We have another scenario where you have somebody who just lost a parent who they love so much, and they're making a Baruch Dayan HaEmes, and yet they're also told, they're also instructed that because they get the Yerusha, they should make a Hatova HaMeitiv. Does that make any sense? And the Alter from Slabodka pointed out again, the question is a question regardless. How do you reconcile these two Gemaras? It's a big problem. But the answer that he suggested, whether you like it or not, is a different story, but I just thought it was an interesting psychological insight. He said, we have a Bris Milah, and you'll notice, by a Bris Milah, everybody's all excited, and we have a big fancy gathering, and we have everybody with balloons, and we give out presents and books and everything, and it's a very exciting time. But yet inside, the Chachamim knew, the parents are in pain. Outwardly, they might be showing a lot of excitement, but inside, there's a lot of pain. And on the flip side, when you have a levaya, when you have a opportunity, an unfortunate experience of going to a cemetery and burying a parent. Outwardly, everyone is very sad and everything looks very somber, but what's going on inside of the heart? What's going on inside of the heart? Is the child thinking a little bit about the fact that they just got the Yerusha that they've been waiting for their whole lives? I guess it depends how much money they have. I don't know. So again, this insight is a difficult insight for me to swallow. But again, at the same time, I think that it's a question that needs to be answered. I don't think this is the right answer, but I do think it needs to be answered. How do you reconcile this? On the one hand, we don't make a Shechayanu by a Bris Mila because Tzara the Yanuka. On the other hand, we do make a Shechayanu HaTova HaMeitiv when a parent passes away because we get the Yerusha. And you cannot say it depends how much money you got. Even if you end up being a multimillionaire from the Yerusha, you're still very sad over the fact that the parent has passed away. So to me, it's a difficult thing to balance. Yes?
I want to understand that a little differently.
Okay.
When we talk about Yerusha, we're talking about Marasha, we're talking about Torah. And so that's what the child left with when the parent died. There's a whole derech, a whole way.
So let's say you have a child of an irreligious parent. No, let's say the child is religious. Let's say the child is religious.
I'm going to suggest that Gadol has a sense of humor.
Could be. Anyway, I don't think his answer is the answer that is the accepted answer, but I do think the question needs some sort of answer, something to think about. I think it's a strange phenomenon. We have the pasuk says in Parshas Tazria, this is a very important pasuk, where it says, Isha ki Tazria, when you have a woman who conceives, V'yalda zachar, and she naturally gives birth to a child. So it says, V'tama shivas yamim, she has a period of impurity for 7 days, and then, Bayom hashmini yimal basar laso, on the 8th day, you should go ahead and perform the act of the Bris Mila if it is a boy. We have a Medrash in the Parsha which tells us a different reason why we do a Bris Mila. The Medrash says, Yilam Deinu Rabbeinu, Katan Lama Lekama Nimal. How many days, how old is a child supposed to be when they get the Bris Mila? Kach Shana Rabbeinu. So the Gemara, the Medrash answers, we were taught that the Katan gets the Bris Mila at 8 days old. Matam, asked the Medrash, why is that? Why do you have the Bris Mila on the 8th day? Why not have the Bris Mila right away? The Medrash answers, Kishem Shanimol Yitzchak Avinu. Because the same way Yitzchak Avinu gets a Bris Mila at 8 days old, therefore we should do the same thing. And this is a very surprising comment of the Medrash, because, first of all, we have a pasuk that says explicitly, Bayom Hashmini Yimol Basar Lasu. We do the mitzvah on the 8th day because that's what the Torah said, not because Yitzchak Avinu. And secondly, the Rambam has a very famous comment. If I would ask anyone, what is the reason why we don't eat the Gid Hanasha? What would you say? Because in Parshas Vayishlach, Yaakov Avinu has some encounter with the Sarash Al Esav, he gets hurt on his thigh, whatever it is, and because of that, we commemorate that. The Rambam says, absolutely not. We don't perform mitzvahs because we learn stories in Chumash from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. We are not bound by those stories. Maybe we learn Musar ideas from the way they acted. Maybe we learn how we should lead our lives from the way they acted, but it doesn't teach us how we're supposed to perform the mitzvahs, because there was no Torah at that time. So the Rambam says, all that we are bound by the 613 mitzvahs has nothing to do with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It's because later on, God reiterated the principles of the Torah, and he told us you should not eat the Gid Hanasha. Happens to be there's a symbolism that Yaakov Avinu also had an issue with the Gid Hanasha, but the reason we keep the mitzvah today is not because Yaakov Avinu did that, but rather because the Torah instructed us later on when the Torah was given that Gid Hanasha is something we should stay away from. And the same applies, says the Rambam, to this idea of Bris Mila. Why do we perform a Bris Mila? It has nothing to do with the fact that Avraham Avinu did it and Yitzchak got a Bris Mila on the day, but rather the reason why we do it is because God once again came along later on in history and told us, Bayom Hashmini Yimol Basar Alaso. If the only source that we had was from Avraham Avinu, we would say, Ein lemeidim mikodem matan Torah. We don't learn things from before the Torah came around. We learn things only from after the Torah was given and from the instructions that we got from Sinai and onward. So that's why this is a very surprising medrash. It's a difficult medrash, but either way, we assume that we do the Bris Mila on the Yom Hashmini, on the 8th day. So I'll ask you, when you say that a Bris Mila is supposed to be done on the 8th day, how do you count 8 days? So the options are as follows. Do we count 8 24-hour segments and then make the Bris Mila from when the child was born? Or do we say, no, 8 halachic days is good enough for the Bris Mila? The answer is clear that we count 8 halachic days. Even though 8 full 24-hour periods have not passed since the child was born, we count 8 halachic days. So, for example, you have a child who's born 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We would do the bris mila on the 8th day. 8 days later, we don't wait till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We do it early in the morning. There's no reason to wait until the child is 24 hours, 8 days old. That's not the assumption. But this is a general question that's important with other areas of halacha as well. You take, for a very primary example, bar or bas mitzvah. So when do we assume that a child is bar or bas mitzvah? At 12 or 13 years old. So do you have to go back to the birth certificate when you're going and planning your child's bar or bas mitzvah party, and you're trying to figure out whether or not the child is actually a gadol? So you'll say, well, the bar or bas mitzvah party is not such a big deal, whether or not they're actually bar or bas mitzvah. You could do it a week before also. But in the times of the Gemara, it made a big difference when a child was bar or bas mitzvah. For example, on the day of their bar or bas mitzvah, let's say it happens to be Shabbos, and they happen to be Mechal Shabbos, we would give them the death penalty if they are over bar or bas mitzvah. If they are not yet over bar or bas mitzvah, we say, well, they're still a child and they don't deserve the death penalty. So this makes a major difference. How do we calculate when a person becomes a bar or bas mitzvah? Do we count that 12 or 13 years, 24-hour segments, and therefore, if the child was born at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then their bar or bas mitzvah is not until 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 13th or 12th year? Or do we assume no? We write down the birthday. Whenever that halachic birthday comes around, that's when they become a bar or bas mitzvah. This is, as we know, our practice is, we don't have 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Our practice is, we assume, on the 12th or 13th year, once that halachic date comes in, they are considered to be a bar or bas mitzvah, but that is not a simple assumption. The Shiltos de Rav Achai Gon. Rav Achai Gon was one of the Gaonim. That's what his name was, Rav Achai Gon. And the period of the Gaonim was right after the close of the period of the Amoraim in the Gemara. So we consider the words of the Gaonim to be extremely sacred, extremely holy, more so than any of the other luminaries throughout the generations. The period of the Gaonim was considered to be a very, very important period in our history, and what they said we take with a great degree of seriousness. Very often, even if we don't paskin like one of the opinions of the Gaonim, we'll go out of our way to try to satisfy that opinion of the Gaonim. There are many examples of that throughout Shulchan Aruch, but here is one of those cases as well. The Shiltos de Rav Achai Gon, who lived in that period of history, who the Rush writes about him, Kol Dvar Divrei Kabbalah, everything that he said was from a heavenly source, everything was very sanctified, everything was very holy, and everything should be followed. Here, the Shiltos de Rav Achai Gon writes that when you have a bar or bas mitzvah and you're trying to determine when the child becomes a gadol or a gedola, when they become an adult, you have to follow exactly the time me'eis le'eis. That means, if they were born at 3 o'clock, they are not bar or bas mitzvah until 3 o'clock, which would mean, if their bar or bas mitzvah would fall out on a Shabbos parshas lech lecha, and they were born at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and their mechal Shabbos at 8 o'clock in the morning, we would not give them the death penalty. That's the opinion of the Shiltos de Rav Achai Gon. We happen not to paskin like that. We follow the opinion of the Magen Avraham, and the Shach, and the Sma, and the Bach, and everybody else who assumes that we follow 13 or 12 years halachically. We don't go to the exact moment. We don't say it has to be a calculation of me'eis le'eis. We assume once you get to the 13th or 12th year, that would be good enough to assume that the child is no longer a young child. Now the child is considered to be an adult. Take, for example, another way how this plays out. Let's say you have a child who's born in America, and then they move to Eretz Yisrael, or they go to Eretz Yisrael for the bar or bas mitzvah. So technically, you'll say, well, we follow the halachic date, but maybe you should follow the halachic date back in the place where they were raised, they're born. Who said you should follow the halachic date in a new place? Now they're missing many hours. They could be a whole day behind. So this is a major question. The Chavetzelis HaSharon, one of the Tshuva Svarim, very important Tshuva Svarim from Europe, argues that no, that depends on where you are right now at the time of the bar bas mitzvah. It doesn't matter that you traveled, doesn't matter that you went somewhere special for the destination bar mitzvah. Either way, we assume that once the 12th or 13th year comes in, where you are considered to be a bar or bas mitzvah. There's a offshoot of that discussion which comes up by Sfiras HaOmer. Let's say you count Sfiras HaOmer in Eretz Yisrael one night. Let's say it's the 20th night of Sfira. Then you have a flight out of Eretz Yisrael on the 21st night, and you totally forget to count Sfira. You're busy in the airport. Totally forget to daven Ma'ariv but count Sfira. You get back to America, it's the 21st day. But you're more than 24 hours have passed from the last time you counted Sfira. So even though it's the same day, halakhically, but in the place where you started to count, you're way beyond the calculation. You're way off. So do we calculate Sefiras Omer by 24-hour periods? You have to count 49 times in a 24-hour period each time? Or do we say, no, the halachic date, as long as it is lasting, even if you're in a different part of the world and now your day extended much more than 24 hours, maybe we should assume you still have the right to count Sefiras Omer. Anyway, these are all very interesting and important discussions, but because the opinion of the Rav Achaigon is that we calculate a bar bas mitzvah by 12 or 13 actual years from the birth certificate, from the moment when the child was born, this is something that there are those who are very careful to follow. So take, for example, we have a child who's born on Rosh Hashanah at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The child, 12 or 13 years later, goes to shul, they hear the shofar, and now they are a bar bas mitzvah, they're very excited about it. The problem is they heard the shofar at 10 o'clock in the morning. They were not yet a bar bas mitzvah. So there were those who were careful to say, well, they should go ahead and hear the shofar again after 3 o'clock. Why? Because it could be that this morning when they heard the shofar, they were not yet obligated to do so. Now it's Rosh Hashanah afternoon. Now you become obligated in the middle of the day because you were born at 3 o'clock in the afternoon 12 years ago or 13 years ago. Maybe you should go ahead and hear the shofar again because what you did early in the morning was before you were obligated to do so. Interesting concept. And that plays out in many different areas. Let's say you say Kriya Shema. Maybe you should say Kriya Shema again. Again, I once read a story. It really rubbed me the wrong way. It's an interesting perspective, but it rubbed me the wrong way. I think it's the wrong thing to do. But there was a gadol who they say, whose child was born at 3 o'clock in the morning. So they say that the night of the child's bar mitzvah, he stayed up. The father stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, he woke up his son, and he said, you got to say Kriya Shema. You weren't obligated to say Kriya Shema when you said it at 10 o'clock at night. You have to say Kriya Shema now. Again, I think that's taking this a little bit too far. But at the same time, where they're coming from is the fact that we have this disagreement, this discrepancy. It's not clear when a child actually becomes a bar bas mitzvah. Again, by the bris milah, it's clear that we follow 8 halachic days. We don't say you need exactly to the moment of when the child was born. By a bar bas mitzvah, that's the discussion in the Rishonim and the Gaonim. Should we assume that it goes by 8 halachic days? I'm sorry, by 12 or 13 halachic years? Or do we say, no, it has to be me'es le'es exactly until the moment when the child was born? Take for another very prevalent example. When we have a couple gets married and we make a Sheva Brachas for them, how do we calculate the 7-day period of when we're allowed to make Sheva Brachas? So does that go from the moment of the chuppah until the moment of the chuppah 7 days later? No. The halacha states that we don't do that. So take, for example, a couple gets married on a Thursday night. So they get married, I'm sorry, not a Thursday night, a Thursday, let's say a Sunday afternoon is easier. They get married on a Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock wedding. When is the last day of Sheva Brachas? So let's say you have a breakfast Sunday morning at 10 o'clock in the morning. Well, technically, that's still within the 24-hour, 7-day period of from when they got married. So maybe you should make a Sheva Brachas on Sunday morning if you have a breakfast together after the Shabbos Sheva Brachas. The answer is no. Because we follow by Sheva Brachas 7 24-hour periods, and once the 7th day comes in, once that day passes, halachically we assume it's all over. There's no reason to wait until the last remnant of the 24-hour period from when they actually got married. Am I being clear? However, when you have a chasen and kala, even though you would not make Sheva Brachas in the morning, on Sunday morning, because the 7-day period has now ended, even though it's within the 24 hours of when they got married. However, there is one place where we would go out of our way and say, no, they're still considered in the middle of Sheva Brachas. The Mishnah Berurah writes, if you have a couple that got married on Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and now 7 days later, it is within the 24-hour period, but you're not making a Sheva Brachas on Sunday morning by the breakfast. Mishnah Berurah writes, if the chasen or kala comes to shul that morning and they're still within the 24-hour period, we won't say tachanun. So we gain something. They're still considered to be somewhat of a chasen and kala. They're still considered to be within the Sheva Brachas. And again, the reason for that is because we have this question whenever we're faced with this issue of how do we calculate days in halacha? How do we figure out when the halacha dictates that we need a certain time frame for something? Does that mean halachic days, or does that mean 24-hour period days, and that would be considered time when the Sheva Brachas would be over? That's a very important discussion. Again, as we mentioned, that applies to Sheva Brachas, it applies to Bar Bas Mitzvah, and it applies to Bris Milah as well. Yes? Yeah. So if a child is born in Adar Sheni, is a very good question. Do they have to wait 13 Adar Shenis to become a Bar Mitzvah? It might be when they're 80 years old. So that's a good question. Again, we generally assume that there's a big question about when you have Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni, and the child was born in Adar Sheni, should they have a bar mitzvah in the leap month or not? And again, it doesn't always work out that way, that 13 years later is going to be a leap year. So it's a very good question. Yeah.
Is it
Absolutely. You lost your pen. We absolutely do use Mixas Hayom Kukulo. Mixas Hayom Kukulo is a concept that we use, and that's where this gets complicated. Because when you have a time frame that the Torah dictates for any given mitzvah, you have to figure out in each particular case how exactly we measure that time. So take, for example, you have a person who's sitting Shiva, God forbid. So you're supposed to sit 7 days of Shiva. You don't sit the whole seventh day of Shiva. We assume Mixas Hayom Kukula. Once you sit Shiva a little bit in the morning, that would be considered good enough. Now you'll be surprised that the Ramban, once you mention it, the Ramban mentions that Mixas Hayom Kukula already applies at night. Now we don't do that. But let's say you have somebody who's sitting Shiva. The Ramban's opinion is they can sit Shiva a little bit at night, and that would be good enough to consider that to be finishing up the Shiva, and they don't have to sit at all the next morning. Our practice is not like the Ramban. Our practice is that we generally sit Shiva a little bit in the morning. Once you sit a little bit in the morning, that's good enough. But because the opinion of the Ramban is such that even if you sit a little bit at night, that would be sufficient for Mixas Hayom Kukulo to consider it as if you've already observed the whole last day of Shiva. Therefore, we have room to be makel in extenuating circumstances. For example, if a woman has to go to the mikvah on the seventh night of her Shiva for a parent or a sibling, generally we assume you're not supposed to do so in the middle of Shiva, but if it's the seventh night and you already sat a little bit, and it's a shasat chak, meaning there's some extreme circumstance, you're going away the next day for yomtiv, or the woman sometimes has a situation where it's very important, every day really makes a big difference, very often we will be makel in a case like that, because the opinion of the Ramban is that even if you sit a little bit at night, that's good enough. We will tell the woman to sit a little bit at night and then to go to the mikvah after she's done so once it's nightfall. So this is, again, a very complicated issue to figure out in every particular instance. How do we figure out what a halachic day would be considered? When the Torah issues a time frame that needs to be followed, how do we figure out how to delineate properly what that time frame is supposed to be and how we measure those particular dates and hours that need to be followed? Okay, so now let's continue. There's a very famous and somewhat poetic Rambam where the Rambam writes as follows. This Rambam can be found in number Dalid. This is in Hilchos Mila, Halacha, Perek, Aleph, Halacha, Yudches, where the Rambam says, Ein Malin Vlad, you are not allowed to give a bris unless the child is Ein Bo Shum Choli, unless the child has nothing wrong with them. So again, it's important to give a bris on the eighth day, but if there's something wrong with the child, you are not allowed to give the bris. Why, says the Rambam? Shes Hakanas Nefashos Docha Es Hakol. Because this is such an important factor. Sakanas nefashos is the most primary factor in any halachic discussion. The efshur lamul la'achar zman, says the Rambam, if you don't do the bris today, you can always do it tomorrow. However, poetically, he says, I efshur la'achzir nefesh achas mi Yisrael li'olam. Don't take a chance with a child's life, because there's no taking that back. You don't take chances with somebody's life, and you certainly don't take chances with your own life, because that's something you can never get back. That, says the Rambam here, is always the guiding principle when it comes to a bris milah, and for that matter, by all mitzvahs. And I think, of all the areas of halacha, this is probably one of the most delicate and sensitive shilas that a rabbi has to answer. When you have a child who has some sort of sickness and is in the ICU, and the child gets out of the ICU, how do you determine whether the child is healthy enough to have a bris milah or not? I know that my father answers shilas from all over the world in all different areas of halacha, and when it comes to these issues of how to determine when to do a bris milah, it is so complicated. Almost every time that I've been with him when we have to discuss these kind of shilas that come in, he always tells me to email Dr. Abraham. I don't know if everybody knows Dr. Abraham. He's a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a very special person. Dr. Abraham wrote probably one of the most significant works of medical knowledge that we have, medical research, the Nishmas Avraham. It's a good sefer to have in your house. It's a 6-volume set. I think now they just printed it in English as well, if I'm not mistaken, but it's worth having. It's really fascinating. And Dr. Abraham not only has tremendous medical knowledge, he has tremendous halachic knowledge as well, and he discussed literally almost every paragraph in his sefer with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. So he really has incredible insight in that sefer. It's a very important sefer to have in your home. So there, the Nishmas Avram, very often my father will tell me to consult Dr. Abraham, to send him an email and describe to him what happened, and then Dr. Abraham calls us back and says he needs to talk to the doctors, and he has to find out exactly how high the bilirubin was and how high the fever was and exactly what was going on and why was the child in a incubator and what was going on. It's really, really difficult. Either way, when you determine that a child is not well enough to have her bismillah, the halacha dictates, you have to wait 7 days after the doctor gives a go-ahead to do a bris milah to then have the bris. That's the halacha. You have to wait 7 days from the time that the doctor tells you it would be healthy to give the child a bris. Not from 7 days from the time that the doctor discharges the child from the hospital. That's a big mistake. It's 7 days from the time that the doctor says this child would be strong enough to have a bris milah and it would not affect their health. Then you need to wait 7 days from that time. Not 8 days, 7 days from that time. And there the halacha dictates it has to be me'es la'es. That has to be. If the doctor gives you the go-ahead at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if that's when he comes to do the checkup, the bris 7 days later cannot be done until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This is why sometimes we find that you have a bris at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. You say, what kind of business? Why are they doing this at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon? The answer is, they didn't want to, but it's because the child wasn't well. And the doctors say, they give an order at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, now the child is healthy enough, so then the count starts from then. You have to start waiting 7 days from that moment, but it has to be the same time 7 days later. You cannot do it in a halachic date, yeah?
Why do you have to wait if it's medically okay to have the bris?
The halacha is you have to wait because we err on the side of caution. And the halacha says because within a 7 day period we assume that the child is always in a precarious situation. The same way by a woman who gives birth. We assume that 7 days after the birth, she's considered to be a cholosh yesh basakana, 3 days maybe, but 7 days we consider you to be in a very extreme state. So again, my father has pointed out many times that nowadays when women, we don't find that it's such a dangerous thing for a woman to have a child nowadays. Most of the time, it's pretty under control. Again, obviously you have many different scenarios, but most of the time, we're blessed to be living in a generation where most of the time when a woman has a child, it's not such a dangerous situation. She's not a chola sheyesh bo sakana. So the question is, would he really be allowed to be mechal Shabbos nowadays for a woman who has just given birth within the last couple of days? Or do you assume maybe the rules change? Anyway, that's up for a discussion. It's up for a debate. But either way, we assume by a child, by a bris milah, we don't take chances. And we assume you have to wait a 7 day period because we don't want you getting involved in a suffix where you might have to endanger the child's life. And that's why we assume a 7 day period. And that's not seven halachic days. That is seven 24-hour days that you have to wait until the child can have the bris milah. So that's something to be aware of, yeah.
So, are you talking about like on the 30th, or like even if like the belly movement is up to, I think there's plenty of brises that are like on the 9th day or the 10th day, not, because what, based on your math, it's either on the 8th day or not until...
Right, correct. So that's why this is such a sensitive issue. The reason why it's a sensitive issue is because you have to have a choli kol haguf. So again, if the child has something which affects the whole body, we assume you have to wait 7 days from when the doctors say it's okay. So how do you judge a bilirubin? Do you judge that as a choli kol haguf? Is that considered to be the whole body is not well and therefore you shouldn't do the bris milah until 7 days after the doctor's given okay? Or do you say no? And that's why this is such a sensitive area, why you really need to consult a very learned and well-practiced medical doctor, because it's very unclear how do you draw the line. If a child is in the ICU, does that mean every time they put a kid into the ICU it means there's something wrong with the whole body? Or does it mean maybe they're just putting him in there for more monitoring because there was something they were concerned about and there's something that didn't end up being that they thought was there? It's very complicated. It's very difficult to figure out when is a child considered choli kol haguf that a bris has to wait 7 days, exactly what you're mentioning, and when do we say that a child is considered to be, well, we'll just push it off one day because he's just not strong enough right now, but tomorrow he will be. So that's a, again, a very delicate issue, and this is why, as I mentioned, this is one of the more sensitive areas when you're trying to prepare for a bris milah. You have to figure out how to do that in the right way, how to do it the right way. So, whenever we perform a bris milah, either on a healthy child that's on the 8th day, on an unhealthy child that's 7 days from the time, is that clear?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. By an unhealthy child that's 7 days after the doctors give a go-ahead that you can do it, either way we assume that a bris milah must be done during daylight hours. How do we know that? The Gemara says in Megillah Daf Chaf, let's look at number Hey. Where the Mishnah tells us as follows, Ein Koranes HaMegillah, you are not allowed to read the Megillah on Purim, or perform a bris milah ad shetan Netzachama. Until, what does Netzachama mean? Till the sun is on the horizon. V'kulan, however, says the Mishnah, V'kulan misha asu, misha ala amud hashachar, if you read the Megillah, not from when it's sunrise, but rather from alos hashachar, what do you mean? What's the difference between alos hashachar and Netzachama? We generally assume it's a 72-minute difference, but what's the difference? So if you go out early in the morning, before the sun is on the horizon, you already have light outside, even though you cannot see the sun. So that's what we call alos hashachar. Later on, we have when the sun comes onto the horizon, that's called hanetzachama. So the Mishnah tells us here, when you have mitzvahs that are supposed to be performed during the day, you're supposed to perform them after hanetzachama, after the sun is on the horizon. However, says the Mishnah, if you did it b'di'eved after Alos HaShachar, which is before Netzach Hama, we assume that would be acceptable b'di'eved. Now, the Gemara then goes on to explain that there are a number of mitzvahs that have to be performed during the day. For example, Kol Hayom Kasher L'Kriyas HaMegillah. You're allowed to read the Megillah all day long of Purim. So let's say, for example, you're a Hatzalah member and you had to run out of shul right before they got up to the time for Mikra Megillah. Do I have to make sure that I read the Megillah right away when I come home, or do I say, no, I still have time? Again, it might be a good idea. Purim's a busy day. You're not going to remember, but technically the Mishnah says you're allowed to read the Megillah the entire day. Kriyas HaHalel. Take, for example, I just had a situation. Unfortunately, last week it was Rosh Chodesh. I have an issue that I can't keep up with the minyanim here. And I don't know, someone from the White Show recently was davening here, and he came over to me. He said, you know, Yishmona Esrei was much shorter when you were davening by us in the White Shul. I said I had half the amount of people to daven for. Now we have a shul that's twice the size. There's a lot more to daven for. So, I don't know, maybe the minyanim are faster here, maybe I daven slower, but either way, for some reason, I'm always behind. So what happened was on Rosh Chodesh, I was davening with a minyan here in shul, and either they were davening very quickly or I was davening very slowly, but by the time I finished my quiet Shmona Esrei, not only were they done with quiet Shmona Esrei, they were done with Chazaras HaShatz and with Hallel, done. So, the problem was that now, right after Hallel, we lay in Kriyas HaTorah. So I was afraid, if I'm going to say Hallel now, I'm going to miss Kriyas HaTorah. So I decided I'll say Hallel later on my own. My plan was to say it right after davening. The problem with that is that right after davening, there was a whole group of people that crowded around. They were talking about something, and they were asking Shilas. I don't remember what happened. And I totally forgot to recite Hallel because that was a 20-30 minute discussion. And by the time we were done, I forgot all about it. I go about my day. I came to Shul for Mincha. It's always a good idea to come a little bit early for Mincha because of emergencies like this. I come to Shul for Mincha and I'm realizing, wow, today is Rosh Chodesh. I didn't say Hallel this morning. Is it too late to say Hallel before Mincha? The answer is no, because the Mishnah says here, Kol Hayom Kasher L'Kriyas HaHallel, you're allowed to recite Hallel the entire duration of the day. So here I was, I ran outside right before Mincha. I didn't want everybody to see that I was saying Hallel now. They'll say you slept through this morning. So I went into the office to say Hallel. And then I came back here to daven Mincha. But again, the reason why that's acceptable is because here we're assuming that Hallel is a mitzvah that has to be performed during the day, and therefore any time during the day is going to be acceptable. And the same goes for Tkiyas Shofar or Netilas Lulav. We also had an example. When I was dating my wife, and yes, she married me anyway, even though I did this to her, we went on a date on Sukkot, on Chol HaMoed Sukkot, and it was late in the afternoon. We went to get something to eat, and we went to eat in the Sukkah, the Chabad Sukkah in Bryant Park. Very nice of Chabad to put up a sukkah, and it was very helpful to us. So we came into the sukkah, and the Chabad rabbi who was running the sukkah comes over to us, and he says, well, did you shake the lulav today? And I'm looking at him like, do I look like I didn't? So, I don't know, I was just wondering why he's asking, but then I turned to my not-yet-engaged wife, and I said, well, did you shake lulav today? So she says, yes. So I asked her, well, by chance, were you wearing your rings when you shook the lulav this morning? And she said, yes, I was. So I said, well, do you know that the Rama says you're not supposed to? And the Magen Avraham writes that if you shake the lulav without taking your rings off, you're supposed to shake again without a bracha. Again, for next year we'll get it right. But, so Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, nowadays maybe that women never take off the rings for anything else, maybe they don't have to take it off for that, but the Ramah's assumption is the same way that we take off our rings when we wash Netilas Yadayim, because it's a chatzitza, so too says the Ramah, when you hold the lulav and esrog, it also constitutes a chatzitza. Now, that's a big jump. Why is it a big jump? Because when you wash your hands, your whole hand has to get wet. Who said the lulav and esrog has to be held by every little part of your hand? So again, it's a big jump. It's a big assumption. But I said to my wife that I think that the Magen Avraham writes that you're supposed to shake again without a bracha if you were wearing the rings this morning. So she's looking at me like, I never heard of this. Like my... he wasn't involved. But, you know, like my father-in-law likes to make fun of me. He says that, you know, you follow a religion that's very close to Judaism that I knew. So that's what we did. There we were. It was late Sukkot afternoon on a Chol HaMoed afternoon, and my wife went ahead, and you are able to shake the lulav once again, even though it's late in the afternoon, because the Mishnah says here, lulav is something that you're supposed to do on the day of Sukkot, and there's no problem to do it at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Again, it's not such a good idea to wait till 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's always busy. We're not going to remember all the time. But if you have the opportunity to do so, you are still able to do that. So that's what the Mishnah says, that any mitzvah that applies during the day can be done throughout the entire duration of the day. Any mitzvah that applies at night can be done throughout the entire duration of the night. That's what the Mishnah says here in Megillah Daf Chav. However, if you look back at the first line, the Mishnah tells us that you are supposed to start doing those mitzvahs at Hanetzach Hama, after the sun has been over the horizon. You are not really supposed to do it after Alos HaShachar. That's too early. The sun is not out yet. So Rashi points out, I don't understand, is Alos HaShachar considered day, or is it not considered day? If it's considered day, why can't I start shaking the lulav then? If it's not considered day, how come if I did it, we assume that that's good enough, that's acceptable? Is it day or is it night? So that's the question that Rashi is bothered with. Why does the Mishnah tell us that this quasi-period, this quasi-day, quasi-night period of Alos HaShachar is considered to be, well, if you did it, we're not going to make you do it again, but you really shouldn't have done that. What does that mean? What's the status of that time period? Those 72 minutes, how do we look at them? What are they? So Rashi says the truth is, daytime really starts in Halacha with Alos HaShachar. However, because we don't have precise ways of figuring out the times, therefore the Chacham said, we're going to set up a system that you should never do a mitzvah until you know certainly that it's already daytime. How do you know for certain? You see the sun in the sky. Then there's no room to make an error anymore. However, daytime really starts way before that. We're just concerned that people are going to make a mistake because they don't have a precise way of measuring time. That's what Rashi says. And based on this, the Stechemed writes from the Aderes. The Aderes was the father-in-law of Rav Kook. He had a yichus of his own, but he was the father-in-law of Rav Kook. He was the Rav in Panovich for many years, and then he moved to Eretz Yisrael. He became the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim under Rav Shmuel Salant in the 1900s. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. So the Aderes writes that when he was in Europe, not everybody was able to afford a lulav and esrog. So what they do, a couple of wealthy people in the shul who had a lulav and esrog, and everybody would wait online to shake the one or two lulav and esrog that they had in the town. Actually, it was an amazing story. Just happened this sukkahs. I was talking this sukkahs in a drusha about, the Gemara says, an esrog hakushi. The Gemara says about a black esrog, that you're allowed to use that for the mitzvah. And that's a very strange statement. Who ever saw a black esrog? So I mentioned that in my drusha, and somebody came over to me afterward, Rabbi Gross. Everybody knows Rabbi Gross? What's his name? From Florida? Comes to visit his daughter here. What? Right, Susie's father, right? His name is Rabbi Gross. So he came over to me after. He always has a very insightful comments. He's a very special person. So he's a Holocaust survivor. So Rabbi Gross came over to me afterward. He said, Rabbi Schechter, you know, I would just want to correct you. I said, let's hear. He says, you mentioned that you've never seen, and nobody's ever seen a black esrog. I can tell you, I have seen a black esrog in my life, and it was the most beautiful esrog I ever shook. I said, what do you mean? He says to me, when he was in Europe, so the Belzer Rebbe was one of the only two people in all of Hungary who had an esrog one year, in 1930 or something like that. So he said that the Belzer Rebbe hired a non-Jewish wagon driver to drive around to every shtetl in Hungary to bring his set of Dalad Minim around that everybody should shake it. He said by the time it came to our town, it was black because everybody was touching it already. It went through so many people's hands, and he said that was the most beautiful esrog I ever touched in my life. That's what he said. So again, you have situations like that, but the Stechemed writes that in his town also, the Aderes writes that he didn't have an esrog that was available for everybody. One person used to have one, and they would share it with everyone. So the Aderes writes that in his community, people would wait up early in the morning. They would get up at Alos HaShachar to wait online. Who wants to sit online all day long? And again, we have thousands of people who need to do it, men and women, everybody wants a chance. How are we going to do this? So the Aderes says, is it justified that we stand online already at Alos HaShachar? The Mishnah says you're not supposed to do it until Netzach Hama, when the sun comes out on the horizon. So the Aderes says the answer is, well, nowadays when we have watches, and nowadays when we do know how to make precision with time, we know exactly how to measure what time it is and what time it's not, maybe this Mishnah no longer applies. Maybe this Mishnah no longer applies, and maybe we should assume that nowadays you're already allowed to start performing mitzvahs at Alos HaShachar. That was the argument that the Aderes put forth. And again, that's a very questionable argument to make, because we have many instances in Halacha where we have an institution of something, and nowadays the reason might not apply, but still, for some reason, we keep that minhag. So in which places do we have the right to say, well, because the reason no longer applies, therefore we throw the whole Halacha out the window? And in which cases do we say, no, we're still bound by the old tradition, because this is what our ancestors did? So this is one of those examples where Moshe Feinstein writes that he thought this was an inappropriate response. He thought this was an inappropriate way of defining the Halacha. And he said, even though we have watches nowadays, and even though we know precision, and we can look up on Ma'i Zman, and we can see what time this Zman is going to be in 5 months from now, but still, we are supposed to be bound by the original edict of the Mishnah, and that is that Alos HaShachar is not really supposed to be the time when we do our mitzvahs. We're supposed to start after Hanetzach Hama. Yeah?
If they chop
Yeah, that's considered day. That's considered day. Yeah, certainly. Yeah. So anyway, a bris milah, it's clear from the Mishnah and from the Gemara that a bris milah, I just don't have my watch, a bris milah has to be performed during the daytime hours of the eighth day. That's the halacha. Not only that, when we have a child who we postpone the bris milah, that also has to be done only during the daytime. You cannot do that at night. However, although you're supposed to be doing the bris milah during the day, and the Gemara says that kol hayom kasher, the whole day is acceptable for bris milah and for shaking the lulav and for halal and all those different mitzvahs, we do have a concept that the Gemara says in Yuma daf chav ches, abzrizim makdim in the mitzvahs, that you're supposed to go ahead and do the mitzvah as early as you possibly can, and you should not delay it. So what does that mean? Does that mean that when Alos HaShachar is at 5:30, we have to daven at the earliest minyan? And, I'm sorry, when Netzach Ham is at 5:30, 6 o'clock, we have to make a 6 o'clock minyan and have the bris at 6:45? Is that really what we're expected to do? Rizim Magdim mitzvahs, how far do we take that? Yes, you're supposed to be careful to do it right away, not to waste time, but how much is that buffer zone that you have in order to be in... in order to be in fulfillment of that idea of Zrizim Magdimin Lemitzvah. So here the Acharonim write that if you wait past Chatzos Hayom, if you wait past half the midpoint of the day, that's already a violation of Zrizim Magdimin Lemitzvah. And therefore we assume you're allowed to be reasonable. You're allowed to make a bris milah at any point during the morning. Again, Zrizim Magdimin Lemitzvah dictates you should try to do it earlier in the morning, but it doesn't mean you have to be unreasonable and wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and daven at the first minyan. You're allowed to do it at a time when people will be able to attend and people will be able to take advantage of being a part of that mitzvah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, so we have, so 1 second. So again, Yom Kippur is a good point. On Yom Kippur, the Acharonim say, we do the bris milah after Shacharis, we don't do it after Musaf. Why is that? So on Rosh Hashanah, we do the bris milah after Shacharis because it's supposed to be a schus before we blow the shofar. That's why. So it's a totally separate reason. But on Yom Kippur, we assume the reason why is because if you're going to wait until after Musaf, very often that's going to be after Chatzos Hayom. So that's the assumption that we do it after Shacharis. 1 second, we'll get to that in a minute. Yeah?
So I have a grandson whose birthday was on Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
And he had just before Mincha.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So that's what we do. We have the suda, we have the meal, is at night. That's correct. We don't make the bris milah at night. We always make the meal as the breakfast. They say about Reb Leibel Eger. Now, Reb Leibel Eger was a very interesting personality. His grandfather was the famous Reb Akiva Eger. He was very much influenced by his grandfather's way of thought, but Reb Akiva Eger was one of the greatest tzaddikim who was against the Hasidish movement. He was very, very anti-Hasidism, shall we say. His grandson, the nekama that he got was that his grandson, Reb Leibel Eger, became a Hasidish Rebbe. So it was an interesting part of history. So at the time, you know, the Hasidim very often do a lot of hachana before they do any mitzvah. So they go to the mikveh and they say all the Tehillim and they do whatever they have to do. I don't know. I'm not a Hasidish Rebbe, maybe my next lifetime. But Reb Leibel Eger also, they say, was asked to be the Sandik very often at a bris. And he would go and sit in the mikveh for a long time and he would say all of Tehillim and he was spending a lot of time. And it would turn out by the time he was done with all of his hachanas, it was already 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So it became a major issue of the generation. Is it right, the practice that he has, to spend so much time getting ready for the bris when he's making everybody violate the halacha of Zrizim Akdim and the mitzvahs? And everybody, all the contemporaries, wrote in about this issue, about whether or not it was proper or improper. So one of his friends, Reb Shimon Sofer, who was also from the family, wrote a letter that he thinks there was nothing wrong with what his relative did. Why was there nothing wrong? Why don't we know Zrizim Akdim and the mitzvahs means you have to do it before Chatzos Hayom, before the midpoint of the day? So he answered, no, the Medrash says as follows. The Medrash says when they were in the desert and they were ready to give a bris milah to the entire nation, to the entire Jewish people, the Medrash says, Mi Malan, who exactly gave the bris milah? So the Medrash writes, Moshe Rabbeinu was the Moel and Aaron HaKohen was the Sandik or something and Yoshua Ben Nun was, holding the bottle, whatever it was. And the three of them were the ones who were doing the bris milah. So Reb Shimon Sofer pointed out, I don't understand. Do you know how long it's going to take if Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who's going to be the mo'el for every single person? That's going to take forever. So why didn't they split it up? Why don't they say, well, we have many people who know how to do a bris milah, many people who are trained. Why not have Moshe Rabbeinu do some of them and have many other people do the rest? And the answer is, says Reb Shimon Sofer, because if you're waiting for a tzaddik to be involved in the bris milah, it means you're allowed to delay even past the time of Zrizim Akdim and Lemitzus. Okay, that was his assumption to stick up for his relative. But the overwhelming majority of Achronim assume that that is an inappropriate way of approaching the mitzvah of Bris Milah. You're supposed to do the mitzvahs with alacrity. You're supposed to do it right away. And the Stechemet says that it made him very upset in his generation when people used to wait till later on during the day in order to perform the Bris Milah. That's not the proper perspective we're supposed to have. We're supposed to perform mitzvahs in the earliest possible time that we can. Again, within reason. It doesn't mean you wake up at 5 in the morning, but it means you're supposed to do it earlier in the day rather than later. And the last issue we're going to discuss is, what about a Bris Milah on Shabbos, yeah? So we're going to get to a Bris Milah on Shabbos right now. The discussion of a Bris Milah on Shabbos begins with a Gemara in Meseches Shabbos Kuf Lamed Gimel Amid Aleph, which is the last entry on the bottom of the source sheet. The Gemara says, Osen kol tzarchei milah b'Shabbos, you are allowed to do all that is necessary for a successful Bris Milah on Shabbos, even though you're in some way violating the laws of Shabbos. You're making somebody bleed, which you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. You are doing all kinds of malachas. You're smearing ointment on it. Whatever you're going to do, you're violating the laws of Shabbos in many different ways, but you're allowed to do so. How do we know that that's the case? Why are you allowed to violate Shabbos in order to perform a Bris Milah? The Gemara says, because we have a pasuk in Parashas Tazria, Vayom Hashmini Yimol Basar Alaso. On the eighth day, you're supposed to do the Bris Milah. Doesn't matter what day the eighth day is. So if the eighth day is Friday, if the eighth day is Shabbos, if the eighth day is Sunday, the eighth day is the eighth day, and that's when the Bris Milah is supposed to be performed. That's what the Gemara tells us. However, the halacha dictates that if you have a child that is born through a C-section, we assume that the child does not have a Bris Milah on the eighth day. And the question is, why? Why do we discriminate against that child? Why do we assume, we're all about equality today, so why do we assume that that child shouldn't also have a Bris Milah on the eighth day like any other child? Just because he was born on Shabbos, he lose out, why should he be any different? And the answer that is given is because if you look back at the pasuk, you have to follow the sequence of events that the Torah states. And that is the following. Isha ki tazria, when you have a woman who conceives, v'yalda zachar, and she naturally gives birth to a child, that's the key word, then, bayom hashmini yimol basar alaso, that's the sequence of events that's necessary to do the bris on Shabbos. However, if you have a situation where the woman conceives, and she is not yalda zachar, she doesn't actually naturally give birth to the child, they remove the child from her, then you don't have the right to do the bris on the yom hashmini. So again, the question arises, what about when you use forceps and when you use a vacuum? Is that considered natural birth? Is it not considered natural birth? The assumption that we have nowadays is that even if the child was assisted by the forceps or the vacuum, we assume the bris is still supposed to be done on Shabbos, because the assumption is that, I mean, I've spoken to OBGYNs, they assume that we only use the forceps and the vacuum once the child is already out, not while the child is still inside. And therefore, we assume that the mother already has basically given birth to the child. We're just assisting a little bit to pull it out. When you have a C-section, the child is completely removed. The mother is not really doing that act at all. So therefore, when you have a child that's born through a C-section, the Bris Milah is not Docheh Shabbos. When you have a child that's born through a forceps or a vacuum, we assume that is, for most part, considered to be a natural birth. And when it comes to a Pidyon HaBen, that's also a major shaila. Do you do a Pidyon HaBen when a child was born through forceps and a vacuum? Also an interesting question, but not for right now. But the more important question is something that, thank God, we have the right to be busy with nowadays, and that is, well, what happens when you have a child whose conception happened through IVF or through artificial insemination? Well, if the Torah says that the only way you're allowed to give a Bris Milah on Shabbos is if you follow the sequence of events that the Torah states, which is Isha ki tazria, a woman who naturally conceives, V'yalda zachar, then she naturally has a child, then bayom hashmini, the bris should be on the eighth day, even if it's Shabbos. Maybe if the same way we assume that a child who's not born naturally doesn't have a bris on Shabbos, so too maybe a child who is not conceived naturally is not supposed to have a bris on Shabbos. Now this is a major, major issue. And the reason why it's so sensitive is because now every time a person has a bris, every time a person has a baby on Shabbos, the mohel has to start asking, well, I'm not sure, you know, did you really conceive the child naturally, or maybe there were other... This is a very sensitive issue for people. Now we're going to have to start asking these questions. And now, it's very sensitive, but nowadays it's something that is a lot more common than it used to be for people to have treatments and for people to have help. And this is a major, major issue. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was of the opinion, you are not allowed to do a Bris Milah on Shabbos if the conception happened through IVF or through artificial insemination. This is a very difficult kind of area of halacha because, again, it is such a sensitive matter. It's something that most often the couples don't share with anybody. There's no reason why we have to now press them to share it with somebody else. So this is a very difficult issue. My father follows the ruling of Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he feels also you're not allowed to do it on Shabbos. This is based on a passage in Rabbeinu Hananel. There are others who disagree. I know recently we had a Shaila, and I was giving a shiur somewhere, and I mentioned this in a certain community. I happened to mention it. I don't know how it got involved in the shiur, but I mentioned it in passing. There was a guy in the back of the room who was like shocked. He didn't know what to do. And he came over to me after the shiur. He says, are you sure are you sure this is correct? I said, you know, it's a big discussion. Rav Asher Weiss last year wrote a long letter where he wrote that he rejects this assumption, and he feels that even if it's IVF or artificial insemination, you'd be allowed to do the bris on Shabbos. But again, that's a questionable assumption. We'll get to it. It's a questionable assumption. And this is a major, major discussion in the last generation of contemporary poskim because it's an issue that never existed beforehand. So this is something that is a very important issue to be aware of. So this guy comes over to me afterward. He said, my son was born 7 years ago. Artificial insemination or whatever it was, IVF, I forgot what he said. And he said, the child was born on Shabbos and we did the bris on Shabbos. What do I do now? Now his child is 7 years old. Does that mean that what we did was unacceptable? We do have a concept in halacha every once in a while that we say, kol milsa d'amar rachmana lo sabedi yavad lo ani. If the Torah tells you not to do something and you do it anyway, it doesn't work. So that's the question. Does that apply here also? Maybe if you did the bris milah at the wrong time, if you did it on Shabbos when you weren't supposed to, should we assume that now he has to do something else? Now what can he do? His child is 7 years old, so that's an issue. So that was a major question. That was an issue. We dealt with him. But he calls me back a few weeks later and his wife had another child. And it was again through IVF and again on Shabbos. And he wants to know, what do I do now? I didn't tell my parents that we had IVF. I didn't tell my in-laws. I didn't tell anybody. How am I going to explain to them? He called me right after Shabbos. He says, you know, how am I going to explain to them that now, you know, you're not allowed to do the bris milah? So I told him to call Rav David Cohen. I said, look, he's not my father's Talmud. He doesn't have to be bound by my father and Rav Shlomo Zalman. Let him call someone else. So I told him to call Rav David Cohen. And I was very surprised because Rav David Cohen is usually a big makel with a lot of things. But here Rav David Cohen said, no, you're not allowed to do the bris on Shabbos. You should lie to them and say, for whatever reason, the doctor said you have to push it off a day. Don't tell them the reason why, but he felt that you're not allowed to do the bris on Shabbos. Again, this is a very prevalent issue. And the question goes in the other direction as well. What if I am a moel? Do I have to go around and start asking anybody who asked me to do a bris on Shabbos? Do I have to ask them first, well, am I really allowed to do this? A very sensitive issue, a very sensitive issue. And let's just mention one last point. I just don't want to keep people later than they expected. One last point is another issue with regard to Milah on Shabbos. Let's say, for example, this is a Shaila I got also from, if you know Aryeh Leibowitz from North Woodmere, so he has a brother, Avi Leibowitz, who lives in Palo Alto, who's also a great Talmud Chacham. They are lucky parents. They have two very special children, or I'm sure many special children, but two that are very prominent. So Avi Leibowitz is not only a great Talmud Chacham and teacher of Torah, but he also is a Moel. And in Palo Alto, he doesn't only have religious people who come for Bris Milah, he has very often irreligious families. So he asked the following question a year ago, which again is not his question, but it happened to come up for him. So he had a couple who was not religious who called him up and said they had a bris on they had a baby on Shabbos. They want him to perform the bris milah. Now the problem is they're going to drive to the bris to his house, and they're going to have all the FaceTiming, and they're going to be videoing it, and they're going to be taking pictures, and they're going to be all the chilul Shabbos. So when we say you're allowed to be mechallel Shabbos for a bris, it doesn't mean you're also allowed to take pictures and drive there. It just means you're allowed to do the bris milah and all that's necessary for a successful bris milah. But here, where we're so happy in the first place that they're interested in having a bris milah done kahalacha in the first place, so is it our obligation to say, no, I'm sorry, we're going to push it off till Sunday because for whatever reason we can't do it today? So is that appropriate? Or should we be nervous that maybe next time they have a child they'll say, well, last time the rabbi said we should push it off to Sunday, not realizing there was a reason. So maybe even if the bris is supposed to be Wednesday, they'll say, no, we'll push it off to Sunday the same way we did last time. Obviously, they don't care so much about doing it on the eighth day. So this is also a very contemporary. We're blessed to be in a generation where we have these kinds of shalos and these kinds of issues, but at the same time, they need to be dealt with. Do we have a right to do a bris milah on Shabbos when we know that it will be involving many other acts of chilul Shabbos that are not at all connected or essential to the bris milah itself? Or do we say, no, you do the bris milah, you do whatever you have to do. Whatever else happens is not really your issue, which just ties it into current events. Now we have the Shabbos project this week, and everybody wants to know, it's exactly the same issue. So am I going to invite people to my house when I know they're going to drive to my house and they're going to be mechallel Shabbos? Again, a very serious issue. My father writes in one of the Svarim that Rav Soloveitchik was very opposed to these kinds of things, but my father himself doesn't write this in the Sefer out of respect to Rav Soloveitchik, but he himself did not agree at all. And in fact, Rav Asher Weiss, it's interesting, when I gave him my father's svar many years ago, happens to be that was the first page he opened up to where my father quotes, and he said, what is he talking about? I can't read stuff from a Soloveitchik. He was so angry because that was the first thing he read. He's like, that's a ridiculous assumption. He was really upset about it. And I discussed it with my father. My father said, I don't agree with that. So Rav Asher Weiss said, so why'd you write it? He said, because the Sefer is not about me. The Sefer is about Rav Soloveitchik. So I didn't put my own opinions in there. So Rav Soloveitchik had that opinion. My father and Rav Asher Weiss both disagreed. And part of the disagreement is because they said, if you look in an overall general perspective, if this person would have been home that Shabbos, so they would have been driving to and from the movie theater, to and from the supermarket, they would have been driving with or without you. Now they're coming to your house, they're having an opportunity to sit at a Shabbos meal, and not only that, you're going to ask them to put away their cell phones for the next 3 hours that you're sitting at your Shabbos. You're saving them from Chilul Shabbos. You're saving them from Chilul Shabbos. They would have done much far worse Chilul Shabbos had they been home and not been respectful of the family situation that you're having there together with them sitting at your table. So again, you have to look at the perspective. You have to figure out, are we saving, in the overall perspective, are we saving, are we elevating the Shmiras HaMitzvahs of these people? Or are we causing greater Chilul Shabbos? Which again, is the issue by the Shabbos Project. It's also an issue by the Bris Milah on Shabbos. Should we assume that that's something we have a right to do, or is it something we should stay away from? Yeah.